Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. This is J.R. Moore coming to you live from deep in the mountains of the Missouri Ozarks. On Sunday, the third day of October, year of our Lord, 2010, welcome to the John Moore Show. Well, we got a special treat today, a new guest, a guest I've never previously had on the show, Mr. Gilbert Erickson, and he's the author of a book titled The Millennium Prophecy. We're waiting for Gil to call in here at the top of the hour, and when he does, we'll be bringing him on board here after the first break. Well, we had some unusually cool weather here deep in the mountains of the Missouri Ozarks, and I think it was just above freezing last night. Tonight they're talking about a frost right at 32 degrees. We had a community pageant, an event here in my community yesterday and today, and the beginning at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, 37 degrees, certainly put a damper on that. But everybody that showed up had a good time and an enjoyable time and good food and good entertainment and camaraderie. And so it went real well. The second hour, we'll have Dave from Canada calling in. I spoke with Dave earlier today, and he's going to give us some information that you may find helpful, if not fascinating. This man has spent most of his adult life up in the frozen northland of Canada, and he knows things about extreme cold weather. And when I say extreme, 30 degrees below zero extreme, that you and I can only guess at. Yes, it is possible for your eyelids to freeze on your eyeballs, believe it or not. It is possible. So we'll be learning more from Dave from Canada in the second hour. So it's going to be a good show. I hope you all are able to listen and get some good information and be entertained. And the first break's coming up, and we'll be back right after the break. Okay, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the third day of October, year of our Lord, 2010. Well, I'm getting to know our guest here. He and I spent, I guess, about half an hour on the telephone the other day. I wasn't aware of the fact that he, like myself, is a combat veteran of Vietnam. Gil was a chopper pilot, a man who certainly risked his life every time he sat in the armored seat of a helicopter. I have a lot of respect for those men. I was telling Gil how when I got back from Vietnam, they sent myself and some other veterans to the theater once a month. Fort Bragg probably has a dozen theaters, to watch a film about the glories of being a helicopter pilot, showing the handsome young helicopter pilot in his very nice uniform, with his attractive young girlfriend and his sports car, doing all the exciting things that helicopter pilots do. Of course, it didn't work. After being in Vietnam and seeing what really goes on there, I wasn't about to sign up for helicopter flight school. But Gil did, and God bless him for doing so, and he managed to get out of that experience alive and go on to have a full and a productive life. Gil, are you there, sir?
Right here, John. How you doing, bud?
Real good, sir. Now, Gil, at some point, you became interested in what we generally call Planet X, also called Wormwood, the Destroyer. How far back does that go?
About 40 years.
Whoa, baby. Okay, yeah. Well, you predate me by quite a bit.
Yeah, the problem for me was, the issue was the mechanics of destruction that are called out in the book of Revelation. I was trying to get a lock on the book.
Right, right.
And what happens, of course, everybody who studies the book of Revelation, the first thing that hits them in the face, you know, if you've got any moxie at all, is that the book seems rather opaque. A lot of symbolism, a lot of strange talk.
Right.
And descriptions of very almost lurid descriptions of destruction. Really, really just extremely negative.
And
the problem
was
the mechanics of how that would be, and it wasn't until fairly recently that a lot of that came together for me, because I'd been writing and trying to get a grip on the revelation for a long time.
Well, and if I can interrupt you for a moment, a lot of what we hear in most churches, say, for example, this is well known in the book of Isaiah, the Israel army's fighting, and they need about 4 more hours of daylight, and they got it to defeat their enemy. We traditional churches and pastors refer to something like that as some kind of allegory, that it really didn't happen. This is just God's way of showing what should have happened, or maybe just God just made it happen, but we don't know how in a world it could. But now we know, don't we, how the Israel army could get 4 more hours of daylight by scientific reasoning, don't we?
Well, there's several different mechanisms by which that could have happened. Our real problem, baseline problem, is we don't believe the ancient accounts.
Right.
In other words, we don't think, well, those people were just about as smart as we were, and they're recording what they're seeing and experiencing.
Exactly.
We don't believe that. We think, well, we're the life is really defined by who we are, and nobody else prior to us counts, but that's not the way it really is.
Yeah, since we got cell phones, the rest of those people back there were idiots.
They couldn't possibly know what's going on. Right, exactly. And it's a very arrogant presumption on our part to presume that humans in prior generations didn't actually know things. But the truth is, humans in prior generations really did know some things.
Well,
and
they're
trying to put it down, you know, carve it in stone, paint it on a rock or whatever. Cuneiform cylinders, there's papyrus, there's all sorts of things, but they took the time to record and keep accurate records of a lot of that stuff and describe what they saw, and we try to discount it, which
Absolutely.
Is really stupid. So the question is, who are the intelligent ones?
Exactly. Now, 40 years ago, that would have been 1970. Dr. Velikovsky, I think, may have died a couple of years before that, not much. At some point, without a doubt, had to come across Dr. Velikovsky's work and his books, didn't you?
Tangentially.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually investigate Velikovsky first. My problem first was to try to get a basic handle on the revelation, because it's such a puzzling book and it causes so much grief for the Christian church. My approach was pretty simplistic. It was a repetitious reading. Just dig all
right,
the time
right,
to see if you
right.
could get a grip on it that way.
Right.
And that's a little bit of a different approach. And I was just about to give it up, and then I got my first insight into, I guess I had to pay a price for that, but God finally turned on the lights a little bit, starting with this concept of how the beast would be built or made, revealed. And from there, then I was able to work my way, kind of up the hill, over the top, and then back down the other side a little bit. The science was more of the recent stuff, and the big contributor to my efforts was Dr. Jason Rand, Return of Planet X.
Yeah,
and
from there, it
opens up everything. I mean, it's Velikovsky and Cremo and William Whiston and on and on and on and on. Just the massive, huge amounts of evidence are there. And those people have covered that, and they've done a good job. They've really done a very good job.
Right.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the... I was going to try to come at it with comets or something, but it turns out that's not a good explanation physically. And the new science is also coming into its own very slowly now, the new astronomic science. So we really are kind of in a learning mode, as it happens. Unfortunately, with Wormwood closing in on us, we're under the gun for time. We just don't have that much time left.
We are. I interviewed Dr. Rand on this show. It's been probably almost a year and a half ago or so. I need to get him back on here, but one of the things I complimented Dr. Rand on was that he didn't get caught up in this 2012 dating, which is going to get a lot of people hurt, and I was very complimentary of him for not doing that.
For me, the interesting thing about the Wormwood, when you finally get a grip on the Revelation and the Wormwood conceptual science, because all I've done is create a conceptual, what do you call it, quasi-science, a scientific framework, a concept of how it would work if the normal celestial mechanics of a brown dwarf star tend to apply, then what could we expect? How would it work? Right. How would it operate? Right. What would it do?
Right.
And it has two sets of events that happen. It has one set that happens, you know, on its inbound trajectory, and then it has another set of events that happen on its outbound trajectory. And
right.
And there's the two sets of events are roughly about 3.5 years apart. So Wormwood is a two-for-one thing. It comes in causing all sorts of grief before it gets here, and then it just blindsides the Earth with a terrible destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then things calm down a little bit, and then, you know, there's a lot of picking up and a lot of, you know, cleaning up debris, and life starts to congeal under the New World Order, and then you get the revelation of the beast. That's a piece of work by itself.
Right.
There's war in the Orient. I mean, it's just an awful mess. And then you get another set of these Wormwood events on its outbound leg. So my job was to kind of fill in, to pick up where Dr. Rand had left off and sort of fill in the blanks ahead of that. And then, you know, about the only thing that we're really waiting for now is confirmation about, because I was told by some of your friends in the Black Ops that they figured it was a 90-degree ellipsoid orbit, 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, and that it had a mass of about 60 Jupiters. And under the gravity-only rules of the road, that was a kind of a start, and that's how I wrote the first round of descriptive physics, how it would work.
Right.
Now we're
right.
going to have to go back and revise that, you know, because the new physics is quite a bit more complicated, but it answers so many more things. Well, it's less complicated because it has less ad hoc explanations for things.
Right.
But
right.
When we finally get it all together, it'd be about time for Wormwood to show up and do its thing. It's going to
Absolutely.
Be very destructive. Very destructive.
Absolutely. Now you've written a book. Tell us the title of your book, please.
The Millennium Prophecy.
Okay. And that is available at your website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same name, themillenniumprophecy.com.
Themillenniumprophecy.com. Okay.
Well, the website is millenniumprophecy.com. The title of the book is The Millennium Prophecy.
Okay, so the website
millenniumprophecy.com.
Outstanding. Just simply millenniumprophecy.com.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a mouthful, but if people need help looking it up in the dictionary, the spelling, I'm not going to try to spell it here. Too many L's and N's.
Two N's, yeah.
Right. I could do the military phonetic alphabet, but people would lose me about one-third the way through there, I think.
Mike, India, Lima.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, my audience, Gil, they hear me do the military phonetic alphabet so frequently that many of them are getting used to it, but it's a lot of letters in one row. So look it up in the dictionary, ladies and gentlemen, if you need to, millenniumprophecy.com. Now, how long is this book, and how do people can order it right there at the website?
Yeah, it's just an e-book form right now, about 400 pages, a lot of illustrations and art and stuff in there as well. Most of it gathered from the Internet. It's a marvelous tool, the Internet, for doing
it
research. A lot of illustrations and stuff are in there as well. But quite lengthy. I try to cover, basically my goal was, if at all possible, to get a lot.
Gil, hold on. We got a break coming up. Everybody stay tuned. The call number is 800-313-9443. We'll be right back. Back, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the third day of October. Gil, are you still with us, sir?
Still with you.
All right, let's begin where we left off. You're talking about the book of Revelation and how you read it multiple times. We don't need to know how many multiples of times. In your quest for coming to an understanding of what this meant, once you began understanding what the book of Revelation meant, where did you go from there?
Well, the first problem was to get a basic conceptual grip on it. Again, because the book is just so, just so darn complicated. When you first read it, a lot of it just strikes you as being opaque. It's a very challenging and it's not an uplifting book, except for the fact that at the end, good triumphs over evil, finally.
Right.
And so in that sense, I guess it's good. But, in between, it's very rough and it's very bumpy. And, it's not, it's just not, not all that uplifting, most of the material.
Right.
So what I found out, though, was that the book was in very close to a linear serial order. It was a major discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And what it came from was that when you compare the long version of the Revelation with the short version of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they turn out to be in the same presentation order. That set me back on my heels for a while, because that's not the teaching that's going around in the Christian church these days. And tremendous power, interpretive power, drops right into your lap once you realize that. So, it's been a long, hard grind, to be real honest.
I understand. So you got a handle on the interpretive power of this, and what happened next?
Well, then I figured, the thing to do is just share it with people. So I started in writing. How would you go at this? How would you share it? And the answer is, you have to write a book. You got to put down what the keys are. You got to present it in an order that makes sense, so that people can understand it. And that if they read the book, then they can read the book of Revelation, and sure enough, everything is suddenly clear in their mind. And that was my goal, because the book promises that there's a blessing for those who read, they pay attention, and those who understand. And to me, that was, helping people understand the Revelation was the goal.
Okay.
And so that's the only way you can do that, is you've got to share that with people. So then I started in the writing. But the science was the last. That was a little tougher. And what happens is that as you begin to crack that, I have a little bit of a background in mechanics and some engineering and, product development kinds of things. As a machinist and mechanic, you learn things by fiddling with your hands and doing assemblies and doing corrective work and so on.
Right.
And that carries over then in terms of how to tickle apart the mechanics of, in this case, the written word. So the idea was to make it clear so that people could read it, they could understand it, and it would make sense.
Outstanding. We got a call on hold here, a regular caller, Jeff from Massachusetts. How you doing, Jeff?
Oh, yes. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Now, as far as Planet X is concerned, I really, it's very tough for me to swallow. Now, I do have to admire you for doing 40 years of research, because I was born back in 1970, so my hat definitely goes off to you for your research and everything. But
I've been reading the book and studying it and digging at it as long as you have been living.
That is scary, but you know what? As far as I do believe in solar flares. That I really do believe in, and if a solar flare hits planet Earth, it is going to be devastating. EMT shortages right across the board. That is scary, and you know what else is scary? That America is going to be a literal third world country. But I don't know about this Planet X. I'm sure it's very hard for other people to get to wrap their minds around it and everything, but it's good that the not to set dates, because 2012, I just don't go along with that. I mean, to set dates is very dangerous, because if it doesn't come to pass on that date, you're pretty much screwed.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I would agree with you partly. We need to tickle apart your comments. The first problem, really, is an issue of the credibility of the concept of wormwood, okay? To me, wormwood exists because God says it exists. Right in chapter 8 of the Revelation, it's very clear. And it uses the term wormwood. In some translations, the word is bitterness. Wormwood is a very bitter herb, foul tasting. It uses the term star. So the word wormwood or bitterness and the word star are in the same sentence. And to my mind, that's a pretty good endorsement. There's this is the revelation of Jesus Christ. And if you read the scripture, he claims to be
Gil, hold
God
on.
We've
got a break coming up. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be back after the break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Wake up, America.
Open the door.
It's time for us to face the truth
with John Moore.
Now, if you want to talk to John live on the air, call 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the third day of October. Gil, I find it fascinating that how men like yourself and myself can come to the same conclusion by different modalities. Mm. You used the methodology of studying the book of Revelation to get you started. I used the modality of locating and debriefing Navy veterans about classified briefings that they started attending beginning in 1979. I have another associate who studied the Torah to come to the same conclusions that you and I have come to. Don't you find that fascinating as well?
Oh, yeah. It's. I wish there was really in time. I wish I had the energy and the head for it to, you know, control all the details, especially there's vast amounts of hidden geology and vast amounts of hidden anthropology and archaeology.
Yes.
I mean, there's
just
an amazing amount of information.
Wouldn't you love to spend a day in a room or of a restaurant with a pot of coffee and Michael Cremo?
Oh, yeah, it'd be fun.
Oh, man,
It'd be more fun if you could be had the time to be widely read. I've been coming at it from a different direction than him.
Mm-hmm.
But his work and Lloyd Pye, and again, this goes back for hundreds of years. I mean, there were your caller complained about there being a lack of evidence, but the perturbation of the planets since 1821, when it was visible and measurable, the perturbation of the planets out on the June solstice side of the solar system from what we call the June solstice side of Earth's orbit. We extend that out, and that's where the planets seem to have problems in their orbits. And then you add to that the physical evidence that's an amazing amount of physical and archaeological evidence, and then the sheer fear that the ancient cultures had of this thing.
Yeah,
there's
so
massive underground, not cave works, but actually bunkers that have been dug into the Turkish clay soil and limestone soil, if you will, in ancient Cappadocia. They had the ability, those complexes, underground complexes, are so large they could handle something like 200,000 people.
Yes, and I want to get back to Jeff, who's on hold here in a moment, but I've looked at a few photographs, but I understand the size of these complexes underground. It would be very difficult to have what they had in the absence of, let's say, Well, you're going to have light. You're underground with no windows. Unless you had really sophisticated exhaust systems, lighting those places with oil lamps would be an absolute nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a simple thing like that. How do you have light when you're completely underground and not smoke yourself to death?
Mostly candles. But they had their own ventilation. They had, you know, they had their own self-contained water.
It was, well, they would have to have water.
The ancient Derinkuyu in Cappadocia. There's people who still live in parts of those complexes today.
Really?
Because it's so hot on the surface. You know, they may have jobs in the city, but they live underground. There's people who are living underground, you know, north of Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas area. They dig a hole in the ground and they build a house down there, and then they kind of cover it up in order to get some shelter from the heat.
And have a $500 a month electric bill, you know, for air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can wrap up with Jeff here and let him move on. Jeff, do you have another question?
Actually, I have a wrap-up comment, and that is, John, you're right about one thing, and that is there is no political solution to our problems. And to the guest, I have to admire you for being a helicopter pilot. A shout-out for that. And you know what? The ancient cultures are smarter than we are today. It's just for me personally, Planet X is a very tough thing to swallow, and I do believe that we are not in the book of Revelation yet, and that we're going to be a third world country. But, guys, let us hope for the best,
okay. And
do have a good one.
Okay, thank you, Jeff.
One other little comment for Jeff. I hope he hears this off the air.
He will.
In addition to the problem of the planetary orbits being disturbed out on the June solstice side of the solar system, there's also the issue that in excess of 60% of the stars in our sector of the galaxy turn out to be binary.
Right.
Now, 60% is a lot of stars being binary, and that percentage is climbing because we're finding a lot of the stars that are binary are actually binary with these T-series and L-series brown dwarf stars as their binary associates. So the new astronomy deals with that because it turns out that the Z-pinch effect that actually forms a star at the beginning of its formation, you know, into a glob of molten stuff to become a star,
right.
That process often almost always yields some form of binary. But the binaries are not always equally divided, so not all of them are visible. So anyway, the point is that in excess of 60% now, and you know, who knows, that could turn out to be 80 or 90% in the future as we pair up all the stars with all the brown dwarfs plus all the visible stars that are, you know, in twin pairs and stuff. But then you have to take that same statistic and you have to turn it backwards the other way. Let's say that 60% of the stars or 65% are binaries as we look out and do our surveys of the sky.
Right.
Well, then you flip that the other way around. That means that's a 65% odds that our sun is also binary.
Right.
And once you start to look at it from that point of view, the problem is that if the majority of the stars are binary, then where is the sun's binary star? And if it's not visible, then it's going to be one of these, you know, T-series or L-series brown dwarfs. Where is that thing? And what happens when it comes in, you know, close to the solar system on its perihelion maneuver? That's what this wormwood conceptual science is all about. And
right.
So, again, you have to be honest about the statistics. If it's in excess of 60%, then that means it's in excess of 60% that our sun is also binary. Well, that's the way it really is. The same numbers apply in both directions. So you need to consider from that point of view as well. People
Absolutely.
Think that there's no physical evidence for wormwood being here, or that it's just an artifact or an anomaly of history. But it's not quite the way it really is. If astronomers are struggling with this issue, you had better be honest about it and say that, well, then the odds are, you know, certainly in the majority, that our sun is also a binary, like all the other stars we're looking at,
right.
Then where's the other star? Which one is it?
Exactly.
And what if it's not a visible star? What if it's one of these, again, brown dwarf stars? Where is that thing?
Absolutely. We got another call here. Our research associate, Sheldon in Tucson. Go ahead, Sheldon.
Hey, John. Hey, Gilbert.
Good morning, Sheldon. How you doing, bud?
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned in your ebook that Wormwood is coming up right along right Ascension 18, which puts it out between Jupiter and the main asteroid belt. Isn't that correct?
Yes and no. The problem in astronomy is first to place the orbital plane, if you would, of the brown dwarf. How would that look? I was told that it was at 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, approximately, that it would be a highly elliptical orbit. It looked like it was in excess of 3,600 years, probably about 3,660 is what we, I think 3,660 is what we used. It might be a little closer at 3,657 years. But that, again, that information is classified. So the problem then is if you have an orbital plane that intersects the ecliptic plane at 90 degrees, what does a 3,660-year orbit look like? And when people go to the website, they can see that. And you've got this intersection of the two planes then, if you would. So the node of what astronomers call the node of right ascension, that's what you're referring to. That's where the orbit of Wormwood pierces up through the ecliptic plane. Okay, now that's about halfway between what would be the orbital position of Jupiter at right ascension 18, which it's not there now. I mean, it's over at right ascension 0 now. But it would be about halfway between the center line of the orbit of Jupiter and the center line of the asteroid belt, the main asteroid belt, roughly in there, which is about 3.95 to 4 Earth orbit distances from the sun, astronomic units, AU. So it comes up halfway between the orbital center line of Jupiter and the orbital center line of the asteroid belt, arcs up over the sun and comes back down through the ecliptic plane again at that same distance, about 3.95 to 4 AU out away from the sun.
Now, isn't it true?
That's the perihelion arc over maneuver.
Isn't it true also that you've had some classified insider sources on some of this stuff?
Well, that would be from friends like John Moore. Now, what I was given, the only information I was given was that they figured it was about 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, and that it had a mass of, their first initial expectation was somewhere about 60 times the mass of Jupiter. Now, with the new science, that turns out that kind of mass is not likely. But it could be very easily 7 or 8 times the mass of Jupiter on the low end, and could be 15 or 20 times the mass of Jupiter on the high end, depending on what the diameter is. We're still not actually sure. You know, they won't share classified information. We're still not actually sure what its diameter is. Mm-hmm. And what this thing is, it's a big iron cannonball, sort of like the sun. The sun, as it turns out, is also a very large, iron, mostly iron, cannonball. And it has an atmosphere. And that atmosphere picks up the charge from space, and it charges up and makes the atmosphere glow. And that's the photosphere that we can see from Earth. And then out past the photosphere is where the heat is generated, and that's a partial fission reaction. And that's where we get our heat. So the chromosphere produces the heat that keeps the Earth from freezing to death in the dark. And so what you have, this brown dwarf, is actually probably the result of a Z-pinch effect in the original formation of the solar system. And it was pinched off and launched, again, in this orbit that is different than the sun. And now here it is spinning and moving at an elliptical orbit at 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, and it's basically just a pinch off the old block. That's what mm-hmm. it is. That's how solar systems are formed.
Right.
That's why they're mostly binary. And so, you know, that what I took was that information, that basic information, and then I said, okay, look, if this is true, that we have this kind of an orbiting body, then what would it behave like? And that's all I did. What would it behave like? Well, it's heavy. Well, it'll have an atmosphere. And where does it get its atmosphere? Well, it can help itself to anything it wants out in the Oort cloud. It's going to have mostly a methane atmosphere. And what will it do? Well, it'll spin on its axis. Why? Because every one of the solar bodies, all the stars and all the planets, spin. Most of the moons spin a little bit if they're tidal moons and it's once per orbit. But just about all the heavenly bodies are orbiting and spinning on an axis. So I took it from there and started, you know, digging in and trying to fleshen out the conceptual science that way. And I think we did okay. We did pretty good. It's not perfect. It's not as good as I want. Without access to classified information, we can't really fill out, you know, the rest of it and make better predictions. But at least it gave us a handle, conceptual handle, that allowed us to see, you know, just about how the mechanics of destruction would happen as described in the Revelation. And then suddenly the Revelation and a lot of these events that have been hitting us and messing with our weather and so forth, and more recently all the earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, they start to make more sense now.
All the pieces fell into place.
We have a mechanical concept that lets us explain, gives us a better explanation of what's going on.
Sheldon, do you have another follow-up question before we move on?
Yeah, and Gilbert, in your estimation, what would have been the last outer node ring that was thrown at us from Wormwood as it's starting to ingress into our system?
Oh, I think the third one that that came by us would have been September of last year. Does everybody remember when that horrendous red dust storm hit Australia?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was September of last year. And Sydney, the sky turned red. It was a bizarre look. And it covered like half of Australia. Well, I think what we were catching at that point, now remember we were 92 million miles off to the side, away from that solstice center line. And as this node ring with its massive EM charge came, you know, sailing through the solar system at that time, the only thing we caught was just the, you know, some of the electromagnetic offcastings. But we were way off to the side, so we were safe. Then the only thing that showed that it was coming through, you had that massive dust storm down there, and this iron oxide charged up with just incredible charge and floating around in the air. It was really strange, really, really strange. But I think that was the last one. Prior to that, it would have been the... let's see, we had to go back. I forget my dates. It's the tsunami in Indonesia was what, 2004, right?
Yeah, the end of 2004, I believe.
2004. That would have been the first node ring hit. Then the next one was there was that massive quake that hit Peru. That was what, 2007, right? Yeah, 2007.
Yep.
In August of 2007, we were slightly off the center line, and when that node ring came through, we took a glancing blow, but it wasn't nearly as bad as the one that hit us, you know, in December of 2004. So the closer you are to the center line when this thing hits, that's where the highest intensity will be of the gravity and the EM charge from the rotation of this thing. And so my best guess was September 2009. So the next one will probably be, you know, sometime next year or shortly thereafter. What matters is where is the Earth in its orbital position when one of these things comes cutting through? And that matters a whole lot, because if we're sitting on the solstice line, we get creamed. And if we're off to one side, we're safe.
Okay. Well, okay. Sheldon, we appreciate your call. And he's gone now. What is the cost of your ebook, Gil?
$16.95. They can order it on the website. It's real easy.
Okay. We got another break. Everybody hold on. We'll get back to Mr. Erickson after the break. Stay tuned. Back, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the third day of October. Gil, are you still there, sir?
Still with you, John.
I got a quick story. I was at a high school reunion recently. One of my classmates, he was a chopper pilot in Vietnam, same time you were. He and his wife are both Department of Defense employees. His wife has worldwide responsibilities at a very high level. I started talking to him about these matters, and she said, "You know, I haven't been to any briefings, John, but I keep hearing rumors about what you're telling me. And, oh, by the way, IBM just moved their preparedness headquarters to Boulder, Colorado in the last year." Gil, we're just about out of time here. Do you have any parting comments for us?
Well, I wish that there was good news for our up-and-coming future. But at the rate things are going, as far as I can see, it looks like the revelation was point on. Spot on. It was just exactly right. And so you can expect to see more political stupidity, and that seems to be demonstrating.
Absolutely.
And there'll be more earthquakes, and there'll be more weird weather, and possible tsunamis and volcanic eruptions and famines and all kinds of things. Things are really going to get messy. They're going to get bumpy. They're going to get rough. This is the times we live in. The revelation looks like it was way ahead of everybody, and it gave us some insights. And I think that the people who read it and get their lives squared away with respect to their relationship to the Creator, that's about the best preparation anybody can do. Because there's going to be
absolutely.
A lot of death and destruction when this hits, and the truth of the matter is that there isn't salvation except in the provision that God himself has made.
Absolutely. And the first thing I mention whenever I talk about preparedness is spiritual preparedness is the first thing to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, Gil, I don't want to be cut off by the music here. I got another guest coming up at the top of the hour. Let's you and I talk sometime during the week and see where we go from here.
Just give me a buzz, John, anytime.
Will do. Thank you for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
You betcha.
Okay, that was Gil Erickson, the author of The Millennium Prophecy. His website is themillenniumprophecy.com. You can order his e-book there for only $16.95. That's very, very reasonable for a 400-page book. This is this man's passion. He's put everything into this book. And I highly recommend that you go to his website, millenniumprophecy.com, order a copy of the book. My opinion is valuable enough to print out a copy. I don't like reading books online. I like to have paper. What I'll do is I'll get a ream of three-hole punch paper and just run it through my printer. And, of course, you want a laser printer. You don't want an inkjet printer if you're going to be doing any kind of high-volume printing. The inkjet's way, way too expensive. But laser printers is the way to go if you're going to do some high volume printing. Top of the hour, we're going to have Dave from Canada giving us some very sage advice about dealing with living in 20, 30 degree below temperatures and many, many feet of snow is what I'm trying to say. So it'll be a fun time to visit with him, and we could take callers at 800-313-9443. I'm going to continue to bring you these guests talking about these different things on this Sunday show where we have live callers, and hopefully we'll have fun together being educated and informed and entertained as we go through these Sunday shows here on Republic Broadcasting. I want to mention real quick, on Republic Broadcasting, there's a article about aspartame I think is very well done and very worthwhile reading, and I urge people to read that article. So I see Dave is on hold here. He's in the starting blocks, ready to jump at the starter's pistol here after we have the top of the hour break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the third day of October, year of our Lord, 2010. Welcome back to the John Moore Show. Well, Dave is on hold, and we'll be getting to Dave here as soon as we make a couple of important announcements. First of all, Freeze Dry Guy is running an October special, his warehouse blowout sale for dehydrated foods. He needs to get these things out the door to make room. He's got two warehouses to make room for more food coming in. first is the individual unit, 3 months supply, the finest dehydrated foods for one person. The usual good price is $564.29 on sale for $395, shipping included. An emergency supply of 1 month for one person, usually $303.79, only $212.65. That's almost a one-third savings there. And next would be these cases of food here. All this would be in one case, one number 10 can each of corn, garden green peas, diced carrots, tomato powder, soup and stew blend, onions, all on sale for $120, normally $172. You're saving over $50 there. Here's a case of fruit. All these are number 10 cans packed in one case. A can of apple slices, peach slices, raisins, fruit cocktail, prunes, and banana slices. Usual price, $219 on sale for $153.50. A case of ABC soup mix. This is good stuff. It's on cold, blustery days. $120, normally $135. Case of rolled oats. Once again, good for those cold mornings. $52. Case of chili beans, $120. Cheddar cheese, $155. And instant milk, $149. Freeze-dried guys, telephone numbers, 866-404-3663. Website is freezedryguy.com. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after the break. Hold on.